you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Rudyard Kipling wrote,
"When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains. Go to your gourd like a soldier."
The United States is not yet even a blip in the history of war in Afghanistan. As far back as the days of Alexander the Great, Tamerlane, and Genghis Khan, many have tried to conquer this forbidding Central Asian terrain with its Khyber Pass at the crossroads of East and West. But Afghanistan has a way of being the David that slays or deeply wounds the Goliath of imperial powerhouses. Tonight, we look at the history of war in Afghanistan and lessons learned that we can use in our conflict today. First, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has embarked on a mission to shore up support in the Islamic world for President Bush's campaign against terrorism. NPR's Tom Gelton has been following the day's events. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, Tom.
What countries is Secretary Rumsfeld visiting, and what is he saying when he gets to those countries?
He's going first to Saudi Arabia. He's in Saudi Arabia, or was today, Oman, Egypt, and finally Uzbekistan. Now, three of these countries are really key to any U.S. military operation. It'd be Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Uzbekistan. In all three cases, the United States would really like to have forces based in those countries for possible military action. Egypt more because Egypt is just such an important ally of the United States in that region. And in addition to that, there's a large military exercise underway in Egypt right now involving thousands of U.S. troops. So this will be an opportunity for Rumsfeld to mix with U.S. troops a little bit. But with respect to these countries that the United States would like to work with more closely, the Defense Secretary really kind of needs to soothe over some feelings there. There's a little bit of last-minute jitters, as one official here told me, among those countries. As it gets closer to military action, there's some nervousness about what they're in for.
So is he just dotting the I's and crossing the T's, or is this more fundamental nervousness? Is the alliance really shaky in those quarters?
I've certainly been told that it's not fundamental, that it is more a case of hand-holding. There may be something a little bit more than dotting I's and crossing T's. You know, sometimes when the United States gets involved with an operation like this, you need what's called a Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA by its initials. And with respect to Uzbekistan, for example, the United States has never been involved before with a close military relationship with the government of Uzbekistan. And the Uzbek authorities may want Rumsfeld to actually sign a formal agreement that sort of sets forth the rules under which U.S. and Uzbek forces will cooperate.
So that is what our forces could and could not do in Uzbekistan or from there?
Yeah, you know, in case some legal problems develop, they'll at least have a framework to fall back on.
What other sources of unease are there, Tom, in Saudi Arabia or Oman?
There's a lot of discontent in the Muslim world, a lot of anxiety with that the United States is, in effect, sort of blaming Muslims in general or lashing out against Muslim governments. That, in spite of the efforts that this government has made in order to reassure countries that that's not what this is about. But the point is that there's some domestic political problems in all these countries that are making it difficult for those governments to be associated too closely with the United States.
Tom, reading the tea leaves, how close are we to action on the ground or in the air? That is, to a hot war.
The answer that I've gotten to that question today is not very close. It's not imminent. But I'll tell you something, Tom. It is so hard to read these tea leaves because a week ago I was actually getting just the opposite indication that something was just around the corner. And I'll tell you, one possibility might be that last week that vibe was being given out in order to shake people up in the region a little bit, maybe make the Taliban nervous. Who knows? Maybe now they're putting out this hint that action is not imminent in order to set the stage for something by surprise. So I am very uncertain myself. I think the one thing that we can probably guess at with some foundation is that military action is extremely unlikely while you have the Secretary of Defense in the air over there right in the region where the action would take place.
When does he return to Washington? Washington?
Saturday, possibly Friday night. He said before he left he wanted to, for personal reasons, to get back on Saturday. So we're looking throughout the rest of this week he'll be out of pocket.
And finally, Tom, Secretary Rumsfeld said again today that intelligence is the key. What is it going to take to unlock the mystery of the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden? Realistically, are we going to get that help from the Islamic world, or do we somehow have to solve that ourselves?
That's not a problem we can solve ourselves, Tom. Everybody tells me that there's just no way. The United States has the kind of assets on the ground, the people that speak Pashto, which is the language of that region in Afghanistan. They've got the context. There's just no way the United States has that kind of human intelligence as opposed to technical intelligence, satellite surveillance pictures and so forth. That high-tech intelligence is not going to be sufficient. They're going to need human intelligence. That's got to come from people on the ground, and the United States is going to have to get this through cooperation with local police agencies, with local intelligence services, primarily that of Pakistan. And the issue here, Tom, is not so much getting the information, but getting it in a secure way, because I've been told that the bin Laden operation has thoroughly penetrated the Pakistani intelligence service, so that when the United States does get intelligence information, say, from Pakistan, they have to worry that that same information is getting leaked over to the bin Laden side. So it's going to be very tricky.
Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime, Tom.
Tom Gelton is the national security correspondent for NPR. For more than 2,000 years, great powers have tried to conquer landlocked Afghanistan. Persians, Mongols, Mughals, Russians, Soviets. Very few have been successful, and none for long. It's not that Afghanistan is rich or large. It's about the size of Texas, with about as many people. Yet Afghanistan has remained fiercely resilient against much stronger military forces. 19th-century imperialist Britain attempted the great game of conquest three times, and three times left in retreat. The Soviet Union failed in its decade-long battle with the Mujahideen. Now, with the West poised to take some kind of military action, we're looking back at the history of Afghanistan in wartime, at how the past can help us respond to the present conflict. Listeners, how should we approach such a resilient, tough nation? How do we avoid repeating history? Or are things different this time? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Joining us tonight is Thomas Gutierrez. He's Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies. Good evening, Thomas Gutierrez.
Good evening.
Also with us is Hassan Kakar, an Afghan historian and author of The Soviet Invasion and the Afghan Response, 1979-1982. Good evening, Hassan Kakar.
Oh, good evening, sir.
It's very good to have you both with us.
Oh, thank you.
We've known each other for quite a number of years. It's good to be on the line with Hassan.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, how are you, Tom? Yeah.
Good, Hassan. John, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Singaye.
Singaye.
That's great. We know and see that you both have deep roots in Afghanistan. I know, Hassan Kakar, you studied and taught at the University of Kabul for a time. All eyes are now on Afghanistan in anticipation of some kind of clash there. We don't know what scale, what duration, what intensity, but it seems possible enough or probable enough that we want to understand the country that we've got in the sights of this coalition. Thomas Gutierrez, before we dig into history, and we're looking forward to doing that tonight, give us a feeling for the mindset of Afghans. Who have they been? Who are they as a people?
Well, I can tell you how I see them from my own experiences, and I kept going back to Afghanistan for many years. I lived there 10 years in the 60s and 70s and went back in the 90s to work with the UN because I was hopeful there might be a move towards peace in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I always found them exceedingly engaging. They're kind of charismatic people and exceedingly hospitable. And they're also people who are very, very practical. And I enjoyed that kind of practicality in their souls. I always noticed that even though Afghanistan was a Muslim country, there was a certain kind of separation of church and state in the minds of most Afghans in terms of the way life really proceeded. And in many ways, I thought that that religion was more a part of the culture than the culture a part of the religion.
But the Taliban's brought an end to that.
And they brought an end to that. And I think this is probably, kind of runs against the grain, at least of many Afghans, both north and south. But again, the thing that always made me return to that country and that which keeps me involved with the country with a real passion and real emotion is the associations I've had with Afghans over the years. And there's nothing quite like an Afghan. And when you have an Afghan for a friend, you have the very, very best possible friend.
And you know, Thomas Gutierrez, I've seen that on the ground in Kabul, that grace you talk about and a kind of gentleness, and yet mm-hmm. there's this unbelievable reputation for wartime ferocity. How do we square those?
Well, these are people who are also very independent, who have who live in a tough terrain, and over the years, I think, become not only battle hardened, but I think topographically hardened as well. And Afghanistan has never been a wealthy country, so the Afghans have always had to deal with learning how best to survive and with whatever circumstances they were faced. And I think they're masters at that. They know better than any people I've ever seen how to stick one's finger into the air and kind of figure out what are the political winds and political trends and how they're blowing. Mm. And that makes them very good. There's one other thing that I think is very important, and that is that they have this belief in themselves that they are, and it's mythological in some ways, but it's also based on experience and history, that they are somewhat invincible, that they just don't know when they're defeated, and they continue their struggle, and you know, you talk to Afghans and you know about how the fact they beat the British three times, and then the Russians, you know, the Soviets, mm-hmm. they always say the Russians, and this is something that has become ingrained within their psyche.
Hassan Kakar, internationally, Afghans have a reputation as tough fighters and even warlike people. Do Afghans share that view of themselves?
Well, actually, they know something about their history. I mean, the common people, and they are mindful of what they actually are and how they actually have resisted the invaders throughout history. But I really share Tom Gutierrez's view that the Afghans, despite all this, are not fanatical. And as a matter of fact, before the British invasion of Afghanistan, the first invasion in the middle of the 19th century, mm-hmm. before that, you know, there were Armenians and there were Jews and there were Sikhs and there were Indians, Hindus. They were living, and they were really, as Tom said, that, you know, the church was separate in their own particular way, mm-hmm. and their culture was different. But it was after that, you know, the Europeans, they'd say the English, and they invaded the country, and the war followed, and so many thousands of people on the one side also were killed, and 16,500 the British soldiers and camp followers were killed from, you know, in 1842.
In the retreat from Kabul, the famous retreat from Kabul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was after that people lost their loved ones, and therefore slowly and gradually their feeling became hardened, particularly in modern times against the invaders. And from that time onward, you know, the history books and, you know, became part of the culture, and people really were saying that, you know, we just fought the British at the height of their power. But unfortunately, 40 years later, again in 1878, for some other reasons, for the reasons that, you know, because Russia had occupied Central Asian states and mm-hmm. the British in India again invaded Afghanistan, and again for 2 years or so, they fought them, and they were forced to retreat. As a matter of fact, in July of 1880, they really inflicted a very crushing defeat on the British regular army in a plane chosen by them. So the British also then retreated. Afghanistan became independent, but of course, you know, its foreign relations were kept in the hands of the British.
Mm. We're going to come back to that, Hassan Kakar, after a break, but you're beginning to lay out for us this history of success, of victory over much greater imperial powers. Listeners, how do you think we can deal with such a resilient people on their own tough home turf? We're looking at history tonight, history and war in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can read the introduction to Hassan Kakar's book, Afghanistan, the Soviet Invasion and the Afghan Response, on our website. Go to WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Based on a Rudyard Kipling story, the 1975 movie The Man Who Would Be King speaks to the real-life challenges and perils of outsiders trying to stake a claim in Afghanistan.
We've been all over India. We know her cities, her jungles, her jails, and her palaces. And we have decided that she isn't big enough for such as we.
Therefore, we are going away to another place where a man isn't crowded and can come into his own. We're not little men. So we're going away to a place of warring tribes, which is to say, a land of opportunity for such as we, who know how to train men and lead them into battle.
You're both out of your minds. To start with, the only way to get there is through Afghanistan. Two white men on their own would be cut to pieces before they went 5 miles into the Khyber Pass.
And suppose we got across the Afghan plains. Then what?
There's the Hindu Kush, a frozen sea of peaks and glaciers. No white man has ever been there and come out since Alexander.
Alexander who?
Alexander the Great, king of Greece, about 300 years before Christ.
Well, if a Greek can do it, we can do it.
That was a scene from the movie The Man Who Would Be King. We're talking about Afghanistan and its history of war this hour. It's a country where the people are as tough as the terrain and the politics are as extreme as the harsh geography. The Taliban is in power, the masses are powerless, and tribal conflicts are at a boiling point. All this against the backdrop of a pending military action against a country that refuses to turn over prime suspect Osama bin Laden. Listeners, is a divided Afghanistan now a less formidable challenge? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us on WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're talking with Thomas Gutierrez, director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska, and Hassan Kakar. He's an Afghan historian who taught at the University of Kabul. Now joining our conversation is Bill Martell, a professor of National Security Affairs at the United States Naval College in Newport, Rhode Island, who joins us at this point. Bill Martell, let us turn to you for just a minute before we dive back into history.
Sure, Tom.
Are U.S. forces and U.S. military leaders fully aware of this history, and how does it, particularly the Soviet experience, factor into the planning that must be going on right now?
Well, Tom, I think everyone's aware of that, and I think as I was chatting with folks earlier on, that we've had a lot of time, even the last few weeks, to think carefully about the nature of the challenge that we face. And I think everyone's aware that this is a difficult problem, and that leads to questions about how we would go about dealing with this problem of the Taliban and of bin Laden. And it raises a number of interesting questions about approaching this asymmetrically, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point this evening.
But in the brief time we have, is there something about current circumstances, the current environment there, that leads us to think we can be more successful than many of these historical precedents would suggest?
Well, one of the lessons that I think I derive from what has happened in the past in Afghanistan is that foreign invaders have always been treated not terribly well. And I think that would put the premium, as we look at the future, on trying to accomplish our objectives with that full range of instruments without necessarily, as people have been debating so frequently in the press the last few weeks, about necessarily, you know, deploying large forces into Afghanistan and seeking to mimic what the Russians did. Mm-hmm. And the clear lesson from the 80s with the Russians is that foreign invaders attempting to displace dug-in forces in the mountains face a very difficult challenge, which is why we have been arguing, I think, for the last few weeks very coherently, this is not purely a military kind of issue. This mm-hmm. is a broad range of diplomatic and economic and legal and military instruments, which is what Tom Jelton was mentioning just a few moments ago.
Yes, indeed he was. Thomas Gutierrez, take us back, all the way back to the first conflict mentioned in the little movie clip we ran there, Alexander the Great. Give us some sense of what successive waves of invaders have faced in Afghanistan. Give us some stories from history that will enlighten us about how it's gone.
Well, there have been so many successive waves of just the migrations of people that have swept through Central Asia. The Indo-Europeans eventually, that are inhabiting Afghanistan, becoming the people who have the territory now. But the thing I'm always amazed with about Alexander the Great is that he came with all those people all that way to Afghanistan, went through the country, supposedly married a woman from that area, from northern Afghanistan, by the name of Rukhsana, or Roxanne, as we call her. And he set up, places, satrapies around the country. One of those, by the way, was called Iskandaria. And it was down in what is today Kandahar, which is the way local people now pronounce that name, and that's how it's evolved over the centuries.
And that's now
Kandahar
the base for
Iskandar,
And that's the base for the Taliban these days.
That's right. It's the largest city of the Pashtun regions of Afghanistan.
So Alexander the Great succeeded in coming through.
Yes, he succeeded. He went through the whole country. He left behind satraps or
little principalities
in various spots, and then went onward to the Indus and onward to his fate eventually
in
the Tigris Euphrates Valley. But so he was the first really great one who came to what one would call the Western history books.
Genghis Khan also came through.
Well, then Genghis Khan came through, and he was been referred to essentially as the Asian atom bomb by a late good friend of both Hassan's and my own, Louis Dupree, and he came through. And the only thing he left in his wake was destruction. He was not a builder in any way, shape, or form. And Afghanistan, in some ways, has been suffering from that person's visit right up until the present. The parts of Afghanistan that had been more fertile and had good irrigation, et cetera, were destroyed by Genghis to the degree that it took centuries to be able to reconstruct parts of the irrigation systems that had been so elemental to the life of particularly southern Afghanistan. And then he was followed in succession by people like Tamerlane, the great Timuri Lang, who was of Turkic background, who swept out of Central Asia and Samarkand and his capital there. But he not only was a conqueror, and he was as equally at times as brutal as Genghis Khan, but he was also a person who did leave some buildings behind, did do some construction. Then some of his successors, particularly Shahrukh, who set up his capital in Herat.
Near the Iranian border.
Near the Iranian border, left some really beautiful buildings and that are still standing in that part of Afghanistan.
Thomas Gutierrez, bring us right up then to the British role there, because I think that's where Afghanistan comes to the Western mind, and clearly Rudyard Kipling and others.
Rudyard Kipling, exactly, and I
had
love
a lot to do with that.
That movie. I love that movie, and I think and I love Kipling's references to Afghanistan.
Why did the British want victory there so much, and why were they so roundly defeated?
Well, the British wanted victory there so much, or they wanted to be influential in Afghanistan so much, because they had their British Raj in the South Asian subcontinent of what was then just India, and later became India and Pakistan.
But they ruled the world at that time, and Afghanistan kicked them out.
That's right, and that's because they were in competition with the Tsars moving down in towards Central Asia, and they wanted to see Afghanistan as a kind of buffer state, but a buffer state which they could have sway, have rule over.
Bill Martell, let me bring you in for just a second. So from the British example, what can we take away today? They didn't necessarily want to rule it, but they wanted a buffer state. That sounds something like what some quarters here are talking about.
Well, I like Tom's point, and I was struck by it, and it occurred to me that one of the important differences is that the lesson of the 19th century, with particularly the British, and later in a sense, 100 years later with the Soviets, is that there was a sense of imperial conquest. And I think one of the clear distinctions now with what we're thinking about doing with respect to Afghanistan is removing a specific problem. In fact, we framed the issue very clearly, which is to have the Taliban surrender bin Laden and surrender all those involved in his al-Qaeda network. So I think it's very different strategic principles that are governing what we're thinking about doing with respect to Afghanistan, and contrasting that with even the experience 10, 20 years ago that the Soviets encountered, which was to go in, conquer the country, put in a puppet government, and to control it. And we have no such ambitions whatsoever, I think, as we listen carefully to our leadership, both military and civilian.
Mm. Bill Martell, thanks so much for bringing in your military perspective tonight. Bill Martell is professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Don.
Listeners, are you comforted that our goals in Afghanistan are different enough that we won't repeat history? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. How will we deal with this tough part of the world? Sean is on the line. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, I just wanted to discuss some of the tremendous difficulties with separating combatant from civilian in that part of the world.
Yeah.
Most of the combatants will be coming from the villages. When there is an impending strike, they will sort of melt back into them.
Mm.
And it's going to be similar to the situation in Vietnam, where we have to use tremendous restraint, because when we go into these areas and try to figure out who's a combatant and who's not.
You're surely onto something there, Sean. Let's put that to Hassan Kakar. Hassan Kakar, yeah. What kind of fighting force is there in Afghanistan? Does it look anything like a regular army, or is it, as Sean suggests, a force that will blend in and out of villages and village life?
Well, actually, I share the last speaker's view very much indeed. The strategic aim is entirely different. And therefore, the response of the Afghans as a whole to whatever will happen to them, that will be different. In particular, viewing the fact that, you know, others, that the British and the Russians, they were so neighbors of Afghanistan, and they were actually trying to subdue them and to colonize them, but to send their troops, ground troops. And that is why when there are ground troops in Afghanistan, the people really do not like them, and they just sacrifice themselves and fight them.
Hassan Kakar, the United States now has about 30,000 troops in the region. The Britain has 20,000 troops in the region. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but no one is guaranteeing us that there won't be ground troops in Afghanistan.
Well, when there are ground troops, the scenario will be different. But other than that, I don't think there will be as tough resistance as the Afghans offered the resistance to the Russians and also to the British in the 19th century.
Are you suggesting by that the Taliban doesn't have the same depth of support in society that governments had trying to get rid of the Russians?
No, what I'm saying is that every time whenever foreign troops appear in the soil of Afghanistan, they support their government, whatever the government is, and whatever their own particular feelings about the government are, because, you know, to them, the land in which they occupy, and also they think that this is the land of their fatherland, that's dear to them, and they sacrifice for the land as a whole, generally speaking. But in this case, you know, I don't think any Afghan will think that Afghanistan will be occupied by the American troops. And also, I think they all know that the strategic aim is not different entirely. It's targeted, you know, against one particular person who is not an Afghan, Osama bin Laden, and also Al-Qaeda, and also possibly also the replacement of Taliban by some Afghans without particularly strong and comprehensive military expedition.
Mm. But Thomas Gutierrez, you heard our caller Sean's question about, is there a Vietnam parallel here of fighters blending back into the civilian population? Hassan Kakar is saying he thinks not. Yet we know that there are Afghans who will be targeted. I mean, you heard Tony Blair say, you know, surrender Osama bin Laden or surrender power. There's been very tough talk toward the Taliban. They are armed, and they haven't shown any rhetorical sign of just walking away here. Does Sean raise a point that could come into play here about forces battling Afghanistan's in their home turf, where blending it out of civilian populations could be a problem? Do you fear that?
Well, that's an important point, but I think, again, as both as Hassan and the other person indicated, that you know, there are some very, very important strategic differences, and I think that one of the things we got to remember that throughout Afghanistan right now, in the north and in the south, in west and east, there are pockets of opposition, and if not even opposition, there are pockets of Afghans who are kind of not all that enthusiastic about the way things are going happening in their country and are kind of looking again to put their fingers into the air to see which trends, you know, which way the trends are blowing or going. And I think we'll see more and more of the those who support the Taliban peeling away. The Taliban themselves are not monolithic. There are nationalistic Talibans, just as there are Islamist Talibans who are aligned more with Osama bin Laden. And a lot of people in Afghanistan right now, not all of them, but large numbers of them, see the occupying power or the imperialist force actually being, you know, embodied in the presence of Osama bin Laden and his Arab brigades there, as well as the presence of so many Pakistanis, students who came in from the extremist religious schools in Pakistan, and even Pakistani military militia, and the particularly the Pakistani inner services intelligence.
Right. So we may not look like the classic invader to folks who aren't on that line. Callers, how does it look to you? Do you think we can escape the pattern of history here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Adam is on the line. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Great to have you.
I'm a Muslim, and I'm from Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm moderate. I don't believe in these mad people. I lived in the States for 7 years, and I lived in England for a long time, too.
Okay.
And what people don't understand, you can't compare apples with oranges.
What apples and what oranges?
Okay, when Russia lost the war against Afghanistan, let's remember that the Mujahideen were helped by America. And the reason the Afghan law won the war is because when the helicopters were attacking the Mujahideens, the Mujahideen get a Stinger missile and shoot them down. Now, what America have, number one, they have a fantastic strategy. They're trying to get the Arab and the Muslim world with them.
Mm-hmm.
They got Russia with them. They got the Northern Alliance with them. And it's going to be very simple, because as soon as the bombs start coming down, the Afghan people start running away from the Taliban. And guess what? The Taliban will be on their own. They're a bunch of about 30,000 fanatic, mad people, and they're going to just attack them. And that's what they should do. People in Algeria, people in Egypt, people in Saudi Arabia, they don't need these people. These are the David Koresh of America. They're mad people. They do not understand nothing. They've done some horrific things in Algeria. They've been slitting throats of people in Algeria for the last 8 years.
Adam, we've got your perspective and your passion. We hear it loud and clear, and it's an interesting point. And it's the one, Thomas Gutierrez, that you were just speaking to. But Adam says, when the heat comes on, that forces may pull away from Taliban as much as rally around them.
Well, I think that's true. And again, one of the things that I think is so important about the situation there is that in the period in the last 7 years in particular, and even in the immediate period after the fall of the last pro-Soviet government there under Najibullah, what happened in Afghanistan is there's a movement away from the traditional elements of Afghan society. And I think, you know, just like in Iran, there's been a need that we've seen arising to kind of get back to the practical roots of the society. And I feel a lot of Afghans must be feeling the same thing.
Thomas Gutierrez, hold that thought. We've got to take a quick break here. We're going to come back and talk about the Soviet experience in Afghanistan. We're looking at the history of warfare in Afghanistan. It's been bloody. It's been tough. Great powers have been turned away. Might things, can things, will things be different this time? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. To learn more about the history of the conflict in Afghanistan, check out our website, WBUR.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the history of Afghanistan at war and its implications for us today with Thomas Gutierrez, director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Hassan Kakar, author of The Soviet Invasion and the Afghan Response. Just before the break, we were talking about the Soviets' role here. They came in 1979. They left almost 10 years later. They lost 14,500 soldiers at least and spent more than $40 billion trying to insert their government. Thomas Gutierrez, what can we learn from the experience of the Soviets in Afghanistan? How did they fail so miserably and painfully there?
Well, don't do it like they do it, that's for sure. And what I think that, you know, previous comments about the difference of different objectives, they had an, even in the 80s, they had their own imperialist objectives. They're still trying to get to Tsar Peter's target of the Indian Ocean.
So they wanted to get through Afghanistan, maybe through Pakistan, down to a warm water port. But give us some of the history of how they got involved and what the war was like in process.
Well, it's a long convoluted story, but the Soviets and the United States had been kind of competing for the hearts and minds of the Afghans through the 50s and 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. in the Cold War, through having a whole series of humanitarian or developmental projects. And the Russians would build an airport in Kabul. The United States would build one in Kandahar. The Russians would build a strip of roads going from one place, and the United States would pick up from that place and go into another spot. Or there was an agricultural project in one spot of Afghanistan done by the U.S., and the Russians would do it down here. So this is what was going on there at the same time that the Afghans are going through the process that a lot of countries are going through in this post-war period of trying to determine what kind of modern process, political process, they might be able to initiate in their own society.
And it came to war.
That's right. Well, but the thing is that, you know, there were a lot of very bright young people like Hassan Kakar, who went and studied elsewhere and came back with this desire to see their country modernized. And they found an ally in the king of Afghanistan, and there was a new modern constitution. And during a period in the world when there were a lot of demonstrators and there were the Soviets interfering by helping to start, a communist party in Afghanistan, and all those things kind of brought Afghanistan into a modern, era in their own way. But in the process, the king had moved out his first cousin and brother-in-law, Daoud Khan, from the position that was the most powerful one at that time, even more powerful than the king's role as leader of the country, as a prime minister. And what happened was that in 1973, he, engaged in a revenge coup in which he enlisted a number of the people from the left, and particularly from the PDPA of Afghanistan, a part of the PDPA of Afghanistan. And gradually, however, after he gained control, he started to remove some of them.
Tom Gutierrez, our time's growing short. Yeah, take us up to where the troops come in and how Afghanistan repelled them, how they finally defeated them.
Well, that's exactly where I was getting.
Good,
the,
great.
Those PDPA people, communist people of Afghanistan, who had been removed, they conducted their own kind of revenge coup against Daoud and annihilated his family, all of the Romanovs in the dining room in the former royal palace.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviets, however, were not pleased with the way the communist coup leaders, Hafizul Amin and Taraki, but particularly Amin, was leading the country. And eventually they gave him some ultimatums, which he didn't accept. And
Tom Gutierrez, I have to move you forward to the time when the Soviets are on the ground in strength.
Okay. And they came in and they brought in Babrak Karmal and others, and they invaded the country and tried to occupy it, and some say to make it the 16th, Republic of the Soviet Union. And then at this time, the Afghans, who had already begun to rise up against the government of Fazlul Amin, had even more motivation against an infidel, atheistic nation trying to occupy their territory. We've just been talking about how they don't like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those resistance groups began to grow. And it was at this time that the West, not really thinking that perhaps the Afghans could ever win, but thought that they might at least bog the Soviets down in Afghanistan for a while, started to provide the Afghan resistance groups with assistance, primarily through Pakistan.
Hassan Kakar, I want to bring you in here. You spent time in jail during this period, but tell us, on the ground, how did Afghan warriors push the Soviets out? What were the techniques they used on the ground that defeated this great superpower next door?
Well, I think the technique usually they used was just sort of, what is termed as guerrilla warfare, hit and run. And this they had started right from the beginning, before the Western countries, particularly the United States, helped them with weapons and money and all this stuff. Actually, during the first 2 years of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the toughest resistance, the most effective resistance was offered, and also the casualties of the Soviet Union those 2 years was really very, very high indeed. And I don't think it is true when the Russians have said that, you know, they lost about 15,000 people in Afghanistan. My own account is probably more than 50,000, 60,000. But anyway...
Huge numbers.
Yeah, large number, because, you know, the Russians, they were not used to Afghanistan, and also they didn't know how to fight. They were just going straight upright against the Afghan Mujahideen, and they were seasoned fighters. They were killing them, you know, by the thousands, by the hundreds, even in one battle.
And as our caller pointed out, the Afghanis were also armed with American weapons, including Stinger missiles.
Well, actually, that was at a later stage.
Mm-hmm.
The American weapons came after 1982. But, you know, until that time, you know, they had their own weapons, because many officers of the army had gone, and, you know, they were really waging a very effective resistance during those 2 years.
Hassan Kakar, there's so much we'd like to know, but our time is starting to run short. Give us, in summary then, the big lesson that we can take away here. I hear you saying that perhaps... the U.S. may not face the same situation as these predecessors. What's
your
view?
As this will be the continuation of what we talked before. This is the strategic aims. And also, I think, you know, the much more important part will also be the means implied to reach their stage. That aim. The aim is, you know, to catch bin Laden and to root out al-Qaeda. If the Taliban don't cooperate, that he will be replaced. So in this sense, if there is the United States tries to help an Afghans to form a government of exile, but composed only of those Afghans who are of principles and pious and don't have criminal records, and then at the same time, because the country is really ruined because of the war and also because of the drought, to announce that, say, one package of help was for the reconstruction of the country will be there, and our aim is just these two, three things, and we don't occupy Afghanistan, and I think that...
Keep the goals tight and keep them doable. I want to thank Thomas Gutierrez, director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Hassan Kakar, a former professor at the University of Kabul and author of The Soviet Invasion and the Afghan Response. Also earlier, Bill Martell, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. You can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Politics is far from our minds now, but the calendar can't be stopped, and it says that there will be midterm elections next November. Our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, looks back at the effects of war on American politics.
History, as we learned on September 11th, has a habit of being historic, of doing everything except repeat itself, of upsetting the continuity of time and, with one epical event, introducing a new order of things. Like September 11, 2001, December 7, 1941 was such an event. Everything changed, except, as it turned out, American politics. The British suspended politics for the duration, David Kennedy points out in Freedom from Fear, but in the United States, the congressional elections of 1942 went ahead under the cloud of war-caused disruptions at home, not yet compensated for by a land victory abroad. Please make it before the election, FDR pleaded with General Marshall, speaking of the invasion of North Africa. But Operation Torch came just days after the voters had jolted FDR and his party, which lost 47 House and 7 Senate seats. And Americans did not remember Pearl Harbor at the polls. Of 115 isolationists whose fantasy of American autarky was repudiated by the attack on Pearl Harbor, 110 were reelected. The politics of the September 11 attack on the United States are the least of our concerns now, and properly. But beneath the calls for bipartisan unity, the congressional politics of 2002 and the presidential politics of 2004 will take shape. For war does not adjourn democracy in America. Perhaps an unprecedented attack on the homeland renders them moot, But the historical precedents of the war effect on politics cannot be encouraging for President George W. Bush. In the wake of what was the worst one-day carnage on American soil until the World Trade Center bombings, the nearly 6,000 men killed on September 17, 1862 at Antietam, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, ending slavery. If the president hoped the dear-purchased Northern victory at Antietam and the pending emancipation would favor his party in the fall elections, he miscalculated the temper of the war-weary voters. Running against the emancipation and wartime violations of civil liberties, Democrats won 34 congressional seats and several key governorships. Facing re-election himself 2 years later, Lincoln was so certain of defeat that he submitted a blind memorandum to his cabinet that began, "This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be re-elected. I am going to be beaten," he told an officer, "and unless some great change takes place, badly beaten." Lincoln made these statements in late August 1864. Like President Roosevelt, he must have prayed for his generals to deliver him a victory before Election Day. On September 3rd, when news arrived of General Sherman's capture of Atlanta, his prayers were answered. Woodrow Wilson was just a week away from the surrender of Germany in November 1918, when Americans repudiated him and his party, electing Republican majorities in both houses and installing, as Senate Majority Leader, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, who defeated Wilson's plan for U.S. entry into a League of Nations and all hope for a stable post-war world order. President Truman, facing approval ratings as low as 23% for his conduct of the Korean War, among other wounds, chose not to run for re-election in 1952. The successful resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962 barely helped JFK and the Democrats emerge from the November elections in a draw with the Republicans, though the latter would have done better, one observer wrote, if the world hadn't nearly ended. Lyndon Johnson, embroiled in Vietnam, saw his party lose 47 House seats in 1966. 2 years later, Johnson, like Truman, decided not to face the electorate, the war having divided his party and the country. But the portent with the most meaning for George W. Bush is his father's defeat by Bill Clinton in 1992, this after Bush Sr. racked up approval ratings of nearly 90% the year before for his handling of the Gulf War. The buildup to the Gulf War in the fall of 1990 coincided with the onset of an economic recession whose ill effects outweighed any benefits Bush could derive as the liberator of Kuwait. His son is in precisely those circumstances today, on the edge of war and recession, and his father's war shadows this war. Bush Sr.'s decision to station troops in Saudi Arabia to protect its oil fields from Saddam Hussein touched off the terrorist campaign against the United States that has now come back to haunt the younger Bush and afflict his country. The record shows that civil war, imminent victory in war, war against evil, a spectacular act of statecraft to prevent nuclear war, and even near-unanimous public approval for the successful prosecution of a war have not much helped and may have harmed presidents or their parties in elections. American politics is resistant to nationalizing issues. All politics is local, Speaker Thomas P. Tip O'Neill famously said. In 1942, in the midst of the greatest war in history against the evilest force in history, James Michael Curley, Tribune of Irish Catholic Boston, defeated a sitting congressman in part by accusing him of being a Unitarian.
Jack Beatty joined us from Vermont Public Radio. He'll be back with us in the studio tomorrow night. For extensive coverage of America and the world in the aftermath of the September 11 terrorist attack, go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.